time for the KVNF local news for Thursday, July 11th, 2013. I'm Marty Derlin. A Lakewood man suspected of kidnapping and car theft was involved in a high-speed chase and shootout near Grand Junction yesterday. The incident is responsible for a day of I-70 closures at the Utah border. KDNK's Eric Scalak has more.
Last night, police issued a statewide description of a truck stolen by the suspect. Early this morning, an investigator with the Mesa County Sheriff's Office spotted the vehicle at a hotel just off of I-70 near Grand Junction. A high-speed chase ensued, and about a mile from the Utah border, Colorado State Patrol forced the vehicle off the road. Kate Porras, spokesperson for a multi-agency team that responded to the incident, says deputies from the sheriff's office, officers from the police department, state patrol, SWAT, and others surrounded the vehicle.
The suspect stayed inside the pickup, and officers had tried to negotiate with him to get him to come out. SWAT officers from both the Grand Junction Police Department and the Mesa County Sheriff's Office also responded, and they used some tactical steps to try to get the man out of the vehicle. When the man eventually did come out, he pointed what is believed to be a gun at the officers and deputies who were there, and the officers and deputies fired multiple shots at the suspect, and he died at the scene.
According to Porras, investigators are working as quickly as possible to reopen the westbound lanes of I-70. For KDNK News, I'm Eric Scalak.
And Mesa County's critical incident team is currently in charge of that investigation. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that BLM officials on Tuesday laid out their plans to gather nearly 50 wild horses from the Little Book Cliffs Wild Horse Range north of Grand Junction. The roundup is meant to bring the range's population of wild horses down to between 90 and 150, the BLM's appropriate management level. There are currently about 155 horses in the area. The BLM held a public hearing to take comments on the preliminary environmental assessment for the roundup, and officials stated they would attempt to manage the animals in the most humane way possible. According to the Sentinel, BLM officials last week selected five places where traps will be baited with salt or mineral blocks. Hay and alfalfa may be used as well. The BLM feels confident it can trap the needed amount of horses with bait alone, but it does have the option of using helicopters or motorized vehicles. The Sentinel reports that some people at the meeting were concerned that some of the horses might be scared away from traps by hunters in the area during the roundup. The 45-day bait and trap period is scheduled to start around September 1st during hunting season. A group of Colorado sheriffs continue to voice their belief that the state's new gun regulations are unconstitutional. Aspen Public Radio's Marcy Krivenin reports on the latest in the sheriff's fight against those laws.
Attorneys for the group of 55 sheriffs suing the state were in court yesterday for a preliminary injunction hearing on the magazine law. It would have put on hold aspects of the law, but instead a judge ruled the injunction wasn't needed because an agreement had been reached.
We got what we wanted, which was to protect law enforcement and all the other people of Colorado.
David Koppel is attorney for the sheriffs. He says the magazine law and a mandate that requires background checks for all gun transfers violate the Second Amendment. At issue yesterday were two parts of the magazine measure. Both sides agreed magazines with removable base plates don't fall under the ban. There was also clarifying language about grandfathered-in magazines larger than the legal 15 rounds. The problem was over the phrase continuous possession. Now, those who have these magazines and drop them off at a gun store for repair, for example, won't have to worry about losing continuous possession under the law. Again, attorney David Koppel.
For my sheriffs who were very concerned about this, it means they can return a stolen magazine to the owner. Because in the period when the thief had a magazine, the owner certainly wasn't in continuous physical possession of the magazine. But this new language says, oh, that's no problem. And it's fine for the sheriff to return the stolen magazine to its owner.
The attorney general is drafting the clarifying language now. Meanwhile, the group of sheriffs will continue to work toward a trial where both the magazine limit and the background check law will be the focus. For Aspen Public Radio News, I'm Marcy Grivenin.
The North Fork Mosquito Abatement District is considering whether to annex Rogers Mesa, according to the North Fork Merchant Herald. The district has discussed the possibility of expanding to the west of Hotchkiss, citing a large number of mosquitoes coming into the district from that direction. The Herald reports calls to the district from Rogers Mesa have been reported recently, and more serious mosquito problems have developed on the lower edge of the mesa around Lazier. The district currently lacks the extra resources needed to provide service to Rogers Mesa, but it's encouraging those residents to organize their area and form a petition to be annexed. As of yesterday, the West Fork Fire Complex had decreased by about 1,000 acres since over the weekend and earlier this week. The Papoose, West Fork, and Windy Pass fires, which together make up the West Fork Fire Complex, now sit at around 109,000 acres. Areas near Humphreys Lake in the northern and eastern flanks of the Papoose Fire remain under evacuation, but fire management officials have reduced the size of the evacuation zones. Firefighters continue to monitor the fire's growth potential, which as of yesterday remained high, and also to protect structures. The fire's containment now stands at 19%. Weather forecasts call for warm conditions over the next few days, thanks to a large area of high pressure over the fire. But daily monsoon patterns are expected to return by Thursday and carry into the weekend. Randy Udall's body was discovered last week in Wyoming's Wind River Range. Local resident Ed Marston knew Udall more than three decades, and he offers this tribute.
I'm sure it was hard being a Udall, here a Secretary of Interior, there a well-known congressman, over yonder a couple of United States senators. The headlines were about the brother of a U.S. senator gone missing in one of the wildest places in the lower 48. But in the North Fork Valley, and with all respect to Moe, Stuart, Mark, and Tom, there was only one Udall, Randy. He was our Udall. He fit here, even though he had chosen to live in Carbondale. Randy fit because he wore no institution's collar. He was not vice president of this or professor of that. He was not a partner in a law firm. Like this valley, he had not become institutionalized. Perhaps because he was free of university or industrial or nonprofit constraints, Randy became a leading energy expert. But energy was not an end point for Randy. It was his entry point into the mystery of humanity. And so I think of Randy as a public intellectual rather than a specialist. He saw connections where others saw compartments. BTUs, rice paddies, kilowatt hours, grazing cattle, climate, technology, the 60 slaves that it took to row Cleopatra's barge, drill bits that could be guided for miles deep underground and then literally hit a bullseye. These were raw material for Randy's thoughts about where we had come from and where we might be going. I did not know Randy well. I saw him at public events mainly. But I went on one raft trip with him and his remarkable family down the lower half of the Colorado River. I was recovering from cancer in 2004, and Randy knew that after surgery and chemo and radiation, I needed a curative week in the wild. It was an act of enormous generosity. I remember that after each exhausting day on the river, while the rest of us sought shade, Randy would climb out of the inner canyon and up to the rim, returning as darkness fell. He had the full Udall genetic package, a long-limbed physique, tremendous strength, great intelligence, daring, and that Udall sense of public service. I last saw Randy 3 weeks ago. He stayed with Betsy and myself the night before he spoke at the June 14th DMEA annual meeting. For some of the evening he lay on the floor. His back bothered him. His hips, I think he said, were also shot from a lifetime of backcountry hiking and climbing and river running. I did not know he was about to head into the Wind River Range on a solo hike. but had I known, I would not have argued with him. I knew that he needed wild country and isolation the way the rest of us need food and water. It is a mark of Randy's humanity that he could worship wilderness and yet care deeply about the rest of us, people who had allowed ourselves to become slaves to the seeming comfort delivered by a massive and unending flow of fossil fuels. I cried while telling someone about Randy's death. This was almost a one-of-a-kind event in my 73 years. I was not crying for Randy. Why would I cry for Randy? In my mind, he is forever happily climbing toward the rim of the Grand Canyon. I cried for myself. I cried because I will never hear Randy's voice and see his smile again. The most accessible soul I have known is gone.
And that's it for the KVNF News today. For KVNF, I'm Marty Derlin. Thanks for listening.